Hello, flies. Welcome back to another episode. My name is Sarah.
My name is Kenneth.
And today we're sitting down with Dan Lamothe for an interview about journalism and what it's like to report on war.
Right. And Dan Lamothe is a Pentagon correspondent and national security reporter at The Washington Post. And in our discussion with him today, we talked about how he got into the field of journalism, his stories from Afghanistan, and what it's like covering rapidly evolving, stressful, important situations. So without any further delay, let's get right into the episode. All right, so we are sitting here with Dan Lamothe, who is currently a national security reporter at the Washington Post. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, so we're just going to jump right in. From our previous conversation, we talked about how kind of journalism is a hard field to kind of get your foot into. So we were just wondering, what was it like getting into that field, and how did you know you wanted to pursue journalism professionally?
Yeah, I'll start with the second question first. I was someone who was interested in journalism pretty young, like 10, 12 years old. I delivered newspapers as a kid, kind of started to get interested in them that way. Reading them while walking kind of idea. And then I started writing for my local daily newspaper in high school. They had like a teen section. And that kind of, the high school newspaper, the college newspaper, internships as an undergrad, like I kind of just continued on that pace. I really liked it. And I initially thought I was going to be more of a local reporter. I was really interested in the idea of covering things that sort of seem to be going wrong in my own communities. Grew up in kind of a tough town, so you did see some drugs, you did see some gangs. The next town over had mafia. It was a pretty decent news town as far as, breaking in as a reporter goes. But I think a theme that comes up over and over again, and certainly will for anyone getting into it now, is the opportunities dwindle by the year. Which, makes it where you have to be pretty creative and thoughtful about what your next move is and which job you accept and, whether or not you want to take a risk for a certain kind of publication and whether or not that publication may actually be around in a year. Like, I'm often asking myself some pretty tough questions about what's a strategic move to kind of create some longevity.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you started a little bit more locally. And you told us a little bit when we talked to you about your involvement with journalism in college. What was that like?
Yeah, I was an editor and writer at the Massachusetts Daily Collegian, which was a daily newspaper at UMass Amherst. Pretty much throughout my time there, I was involved kind of in passing as a freshman. I wrote columns, but really from sophomore year to senior year, I was very involved, running one section or another. I was an assistant op-ed editor, then a news editor, then I ran the newsroom as a senior, as a managing editor. And I loved it. I mean, the pace was intense. It was a big enough campus where there was a lot of actual real serious news. Riots, campus takeovers of certain buildings, sadly student deaths was something that I wrote about a number of times, everything from drug overdoses to car wrecks, in kind of a way that ripples through the community, that it's not just like a random name on a random Tuesday in the newspaper, that there's always a longer, deeper story that's worth telling.
And if I recall, you were in college around 9/11.
Yeah. I was a sophomore, actually in a journalism class. When I found out about 9/11, I had a 9 a.m. Basically like an introduction to news writing class. Tuesday morning, beautiful morning. I mean, you've all heard the description of the blue sky and all that. I mean, all that held true to me. And my impulse, we had an assignment. I think we were all kind of grappling with what even was it at that moment. Like, it was so weird and nebulous, it didn't even make sense. So my professor, who was also a mentor, suggested, hey, why don't you finish your assignments, you know, feel free to leave and do whatever you want after that. You don't have to stick around for the whole hour kind of thing. And my impulse, I went straight to the newsroom. And that's kind of what I've been doing ever since, I suppose.
So after 9/11, you kind of found yourself engrossed in reporting on, you know, not necessarily positive news. How did you find yourself reporting on military? Because that is such a huge shift from, let's just say, like, local journalism.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the short answer is I kind of fell into it. But I don't think that's an atypical story. I mean, the opportunity opens in a place you didn't necessarily anticipate. You either go through the door or you don't. When I first came to Washington, I was a graduate student at the University of Maryland. And I was kind of, I came down with hopes that it would be a springboard into some big time, full-time internships, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post, something like that. And I applied for pretty much all those and got denied across the board. So it was kind of a, okay, what's next moment for me? And I ended up going to the Baltimore Sun unpaid a couple days a week while continuing to work on campus. And that was not ideal. That's still not ideal. I know there's a whole discussion about whether or not unpaid internships are okay. But for me, it was at least an opportunity to keep trying. My editor there was married to an editor at the Military Times newspaper chain, which is an independent chain covering the military, but very closely and kind of for active duty readers. So you kind of have to learn it in a way and in a depth that you don't in mainstream news. So I started there in 08 after graduating with a master's degree, started traveling in 2010 and jumped into covering ground combat in Afghanistan. Three pretty long trips between 2010 and 2012. Really formative stuff. I mean, stuff that I'm really proud I did and, you know, really adventurous stuff, but also, you know, pretty scary stuff at times.
Right. And, like, I'm just curious, as someone who's also interested in journalism myself, how does actually seeing the conflict live with your own eyes affect your ability to report on it? Because you do have to provide unbiased information.
Yeah, the military is fond of using this term, the soda straw. The idea being that when you're with a unit or you're out there, you're going to get a very specific point of view that you basically see almost as though you were looking through a soda straw. Very pinpoint view of a certain thing, and you're kind of maybe missing the bigger picture. For me, you kind of have to do all of the above. There's great, immense value in walking a foot patrol with an active duty unit as they are searching it for the Taliban or whatever else the current operation of the day is. So when I was doing that, you know, like getting that appreciation for why a unit is getting shot at from a certain ridge, what the Taliban is using for IED tactics on a given month, which varies over time, gives you a much greater appreciation. It also allows you to humanize your stories in a way you never could from Washington. You know, a lot of those trips, like I'm still in touch with people that I met back in 2010, you know, on patrols. Like there's real value in gaining that. I mean, I think to be fair, the flip side of the argument is there's obviously the other side. There's the Afghan villagers' point of view. There's the Afghan government's point of view. There's the bigger picture of whether or not a mission makes sense in the first place. You know, how it's going on a given week is one thing, but then there's the larger discussion of strategically, is it sustainable? Is it sensible? The costs associated with both financially and in terms of lives and limbs. So, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about that too.
I think something that often gets lost in talking about the Middle East or Afghanistan specifically is there's almost a tendency from a removed American perspective to think of it as all desert or something along those lines that is not how it is in reality. And I remember you have said in the past that you would have very beautiful landscape juxtaposed with the threat of death at every turn. What was that like? How did you cope with that?
Yeah, I mean, there were places that were desert landscapes in southern Afghanistan where I was, but there was also areas that had these beautiful mountains and, you know, farmland with these canals. And one of the places that really, you know, resonated with me, there's a place called Kajaki. It's got this big dam basically a waterfall with like a real hydroelectric dam that the United States and partners built back in the 1950s. It's still providing electricity to that area now. But it looks like a resort, right down to having a dry swimming pool on the middle of the base that the Russians built back in the 1980s. Making sense of that. And actually, I should clarify, I'm not even sure if it was the Russians who built it or if it goes back even farther than that. I know they used it. It was an R&R base, like a rest base for the Russians back in the day. But you juxtapose like those foot patrols with like sitting on the side of that mountain as the sun sets. And it's, some of the photographs I took, like, those are things you can't repeat.
And I remember as well, when you think about tragedy that you have seen, you've said in the past again that on one of your first couple days in Afghanistan, you saw something very, very tragic that stuck with you, related to a man named Christopher Rangel.
My very first night with the infantry battalion that I embedded with, it takes several days to get out to that point of like being with the actual unit doing foot patrols. You're embedded, but you're waiting on helicopter rides and things like that. But I arrived and, sun was setting and I'm starting to see Marines hug each other and Marines crying. And I've been there maybe 3 hours at that point. As it turns out, in a place not too far off of that location, a Marine had been shot by a sniper that very day. Play that forward, there's a difficulty in trying to navigate how to report that, when to report that, in terms of what happened. And then there's the larger picture of, over the next couple weeks, I'm on foot patrol relying on some of Chris Rangel's friends for my own security. It kind of has layers to it.
I honestly couldn't imagine having to process that. And at the same time, like in the back of your mind, you have deadlines and you have to produce articles and provide people with all this information and updates on the conflict. So I'm just curious to hear how do you deal with that? How do you put that, like put all your emotions kind of in the back of your mind and focus on your work instead?
For me, there's a, I think it's twofold. I think one, writing is a form of therapy for a lot of people who do it. Two, I think there's a compartmentalization that's necessary where you're like, all right, I have a task at hand. I must take care of this and I'll deal with my own, baggage on this at a later time. I think it's important you deal with that baggage, but you don't have to deal with your baggage immediately or even this week.
Right. And moving back and forth between Afghanistan and the U.S., how do you cope with the constant movement? Does it at all affect your writing? Does it kind of help you get a better picture of the situation, but also that can't be easy emotionally to keep moving back and forth between such drastically different environments?
I found it had pros and cons. It certainly sharpened my writing even when I got back home. You're there last month, that's going to carry for at least a few months where it's going to be similar. It evolves over time, but it's similar. You can kind of picture what it tastes and feels like. But it can be kind of jarring. I spend a lot of time around veterans, as you probably expect with my job. And I've had long conversations with some of them about what it was like back in the day with World War II, where you got on a ship and you came home and it took days and the whole unit came home together. And I think there's a lot of World War II that's obviously had a lot of baggage that they were dealing with and continue to deal with. But one of the things that I think the more recent vets have pointed out to me on occasion is that they all came home together and it took time and there was a window of maybe time to process. I don't know how whimsical or, how well that carried actually in practicality, but that's still different than being on a patrol on Tuesday, and in my case being on a civilian aircraft back home on a Thursday. It can be pretty jarring.
So on that note of vets coming home, I want to move a little bit forward to the Biden administration, which, as most people know, withdrew troops from Afghanistan. And you played a big role in covering that at the Post during that time. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it really, it even goes back to the tail end of the Trump administration as well. You have the signing of a peace deal, at least nominally called a peace deal, that really kind of set it up where U.S. troops would be withdrawn. And it was supposed to be conditions-based, but there was always a lot of question marks about whether that would really hold. The numbers kept declining, even though the Taliban kept taking territory. And I think a lot of us who had spent a lot of time there, you know, were looking at that with a both a concerned and critical eye. You know, just the talking points didn't hold up. Biden administration takes over. Taliban continues to take territory. And you end up with this multi-month review at the very beginning of the Biden administration. And he ultimately announces in April, several months into his term, that he will be withdrawing everybody, seemingly, leaving a few hundred soldiers around the embassy, basically. And that in itself already felt, I think, like such a important thing and also something that might not hold in reality. This idea that you're trying to backstop the government in Kabul as basically the bubble around Kabul gets smaller and smaller and smaller. It's something that, you know, in history books you saw with Vietnam as well, of the United States kind of getting people out over time and the question mark of how long the government that the United States has been supporting for years can stand on its own two feet. And in this case, it wasn't very long at all. And you ended up with that, you know, horrifying couple of weeks where not only the U.S. Diplomats and others, but, you know, thousands and thousands of Afghans who had a legitimate claim to getting out of the country after years of supporting the Americans and putting themselves at risk. And they are still there. There are still many there. There are still getting some out, even now, 2+ years later. But there are still people there, and there are still people arriving in the United States on a pretty frequent trajectory. I'm kind of on the side. I spend some time trying to assist a group in Arlington, Virginia, where Afghans are arriving, and it's like, you know, hey, we've got this family of 5, 3 kids, mom, dad. They're going to be in a 1 or 2 bedroom apartment. Anybody willing to chip in for some furniture or, you know, real basic stuff, just to try to get, you know, these folks on their feet.
Absolutely. And I imagine there was a level of stress too in reporting on a developing situation and almost racing against other outlets to get published what you had to publish. Talk through for us what it was like getting that out there as fast as you could, getting the information you had and finding the information and putting it together.
It was a weird few weeks, partly because we could all see that it was crumbling and it was just a question of how quickly at that point. But also I found myself talking to folks I hadn't talked to in 10 years in some cases. I found a lot of people who don't typically talk to the media seeking us out. They were furious. They were heartbroken. They were alarmed. Many of them knew people that were caught in the middle of it. So I ended up in this rhythm of working hard all day, taking a couple hours off, and then my phone would often start ringing again at 11 or 12 o'clock at night in Washington, as Kabul woke up. And I'd end up in this rhythm of like getting out of bed to like take a phone call. And that's not something that's sustainable, but in that moment, in that 2-week window, maybe, it's all that mattered.
And, you know, just to kind of shift conversation a little bit towards why it's so important to get these stories out so quickly, and especially in such a developing conflict like Afghanistan, and even now looking towards Ukraine and Israel, why do you think it is so crucial that we get those stories out first, especially when we consider mitigating misinformation and disinformation?
We spend a lot of time thinking about how we're being spun or they're trying to spin us. And I mean, in a conflict, everybody, U.S. officials, Ukrainian officials, Russian officials, everybody has a vested interest in putting their best face on something.
Right.
So we're often trying to sort through that. And the best thing we can do is just talk to as many people as we can from all different facets. We're also sorting through everything that's open source, how much of it's real, how much of it's doctored. I have colleagues who spend a great deal of time looking at, you know, photos and videos that appear on social media sites and trying to make sense of if they're actually real, credible. Is there metadata in a photograph that tells you it was actually taking place in, you know, taken in a given town? Okay, well, now we can at least say that photo is legitimately captured in a given location. You know, and then there's other stuff where you're like, oh, that went viral, but that's actually a video game clip that somebody slapped on and said was actually a, you know, recent fight. And I mean, all of this gets so real over time that, like, it's pretty easy for something to take off and have no validity to it.
So I think on that note, a very present day example that I think you've been dealing with a lot over the past week at the Post is that a 25-year-old U.S. airman, Aaron Bushnell, recently self-immolated outside the Israeli embassy. How has that played out for you at the Post over the last week?
I mean, so it happened on a weekend. So we have reporters who are on duty. We kind of take turns with weekend duty. So I didn't see it right away. The initial report was a man in a military uniform. And we were kind of sorting through whether it was really, truly somebody in the military, because there's a lot of people who wear uniforms that didn't serve, and there are a lot of people who lie about did serve, you know, that they did serve. So it was kind of iterative, where you're starting with, okay, this is what happened. Now, is what's being said true? Okay, let me go to the Air Force and try to verify that. I have colleagues talking to the local police, and then we're kind of teaming up and working through the information to make sense of what overlaps and what seems legit. You know, one of my colleagues, Emily Davies, was talking to his friends pretty quickly. You know, people that were heartbroken by his death, that knew him, that heard from him in his last 24 hours. You know, and we're putting that against what he's saying and, you know, his own military service. And I think it's going to take months to truly have a full appreciation for what he did and why. I mean, he stated what he did and why, but what's the rest of it?
Yeah, and obviously that situation is very difficult to manage as a reporter, and we'll be following it, what you're reporting and what everybody's reporting over the next couple of weeks on this specific situation, but also the broader conflict. So moving into our lightning round, do on the fly, we're going to ask just a quick few questions, short answers to end this interview.
Okay.
So I'll go first. What is your go-to perfect environment when you sit down and you write an article? Like, what's the drink of choice? What's the seating arrangement?
I've got two, and they're weather dependent.
Okay.
So my wife and I put a screen porch on our house last year. When the weather's nice, I love being out there.
Yeah.
I actually have an office chair on the screen porch because I'm out there so often writing. It looks ridiculous. I mean, it's like, you know, all of your, like, nice white outdoor furniture with cushions and the office chair at the end of the table. But she's fine with it, and I'm appreciative of that, and I'm in that chair pretty much any time it's at least 50-something degrees.
Okay.
Second, I always like to ask this. What, in a sentence, would be your advice for college students interested in a career similar to your own?
Try and plan ahead, but understand that that plan will never survive first contact, and that you will constantly need to be assessing what the next opportunity is, because it will appear in places you don't expect, and that opportunities you do think you might get will disappear.
So, on a less serious note, if you could profile any cartoon character, who would it be?
You know, I was a big Donald Duck fan as a child. Let's go with that.
Okay.
All right. Aside from journalism, do you have a favorite form of writing?
I read a lot of biographies and things of that sort. I'm not really a like free-flowing, truly creative writer. I mean, I try to infuse that into what I'm doing, but yeah, I would say sort of like the narrative journalism stuff, like the more like long-form magazine style stuff, which I can do from time to time, but I'm obviously stuck on hard news a lot too.
Absolutely.
And something that I personally experience a lot, writer's block. I was just wondering how do you deal with that? Because you know, you're on such strict deadlines, like sometimes you can't afford to have a writer's block.
For me, on the short deadline stuff, it's pretty straightforward. Okay. I don't but what writer's block for me doesn't apply when it's like, hey, you have 90 minutes, get out the best version of this version of events, and there's kind of a formula to it, and it's basically, is this usable or not, and then making sense of it. The creative stuff, the feature stories, that is often more tricky.
Right.
For me, it's often taking a step away from it. I'll take a long walk with my dog. I'll go play softball. I'll fire up the lawnmower, just something that's unrelated, and just get away from it for a while. And often I'm thinking about it while I do those other things.
What kind of dog do you have?
He is a 5-year-old lab mix. He's about 25% lab and then a lot of other things. He's named Pedro.
Oh, very sweet.
Well, and one more that I always like to ask. I imagine at 5 years old, you weren't itching to be a national security reporter. So when you were 5, what did you want to be when you grew up?
At 5, I don't...
Or as a kid.
Yeah.
More broadly.
I mean, I thought about coaching basketball. You know, I don't know about 5, but maybe at 12.
Right.
yeah. You know, like there was an alternate version of this where maybe I would have been a teacher and coach somewhere.
Absolutely.
And I actually think this opportunity at Georgetown has allowed me to scratch a little bit of that itch.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We had a lovely time interviewing you.
Thank you.
Perfect. Have a nice day.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to The Fly. You can find us on social media at The Fly Georgetown. If you enjoyed our conversation, make sure to subscribe to The Fly and leave a 5-star rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or SoundCloud. Our researchers are Kenneth Jackson, Julian Zeitlinger, Abigail Asadi, and Chase Dobson. Our communications team is Andrea Smith, Austin Culpepper, Darius Wagner, and Sarah Sverdlov. Our production team is Will Hayes and David Grice. Original theme music is composed by Ada Ng and Bella Carlucci. And I'm Fiona Gallagher, Managing Director of the Pod. The Fly is brought to you by the Georgetown University Institute of Politics and Public Service and is made possible by the McCourt School of Public Policy. Thanks so much for listening, and fly with you soon.